Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2020. This is the second night, and this is the final stream of the second night. We are only on DLive for this one, not YouTube. And I just suspect that what is said in this stream might be against YouTube's rules at this point with the election. We're going to concentrate on the US election, which has just happened. For the benefit of anyone watching in a million years, there's just been an election in the United States of America between Trump and Joe Biden. And it looks to me like some pretty shady stuff went on. So we're going to talk about that here. I think it should be quite a good idea to have a stream that's specifically about that. It's going to come up in loads of others on Millennial, and it already has done. But I think it's good to get one specifically on it, and I think Blackpilled is the guy to talk about it. So welcome, Devin Stack of Blackpilled.
Yeah, thanks for having me on again. It's I think this is the third year.
Third.
That's awesome. Yeah. So no, I appreciate the invite.
All right, it's you're always a popular guest, so no dilemma about asking you on this year as well. All right, so let's get started. Someone's saying title needs updating, and oh, so it does. Don't worry about that. I'll see what I can do. All right. So in the meantime, let's get to the topic. So what would you say? I mean, I don't know. Where do you want to begin this story? We could stay. I think probably necessary to start it in 2016, just to lay the groundwork. What happened in 2016 that is relevant today?
Well, I think what happened in 2016 is we had, I'd say the white working class Americans were starting to really feel for the first time in large numbers the existential threat that the left presented to them. And they were tired of electing the same old kind of Republicans over and over and over again. Republicans ranging from George W. Bush to having candidates that couldn't win, like McCain, who were of the same ilk, or Romney of the same, the same kind of pedigree. And they realized that when they won, with in the case of George W., or you could even go back to Reagan in this respect, the things that they wanted to limit immigration and to remove this existential threat, or at least address it in some meaningful way, nothing ever happened. And in fact, when things did happen, it was just put on hold. Things were just put on hold. I remember specifically during W's administration, they were going to give amnesty to a lot of these. DACA didn't exist at the time, but they were still. It's funny because they've been saying, "Oh, there's 11 million illegal immigrants in America," and that number doesn't seem to ever change, even though it's like 20 years later, right? And they were saying there's 11 million illegal immigrants, and there has to be a pathway to citizenship, and Rush Limbaugh, of all people, actually led the charge, got a bunch of people calling in, and they ended up shutting the phones down at the White House, and it put it on hold. But that's all that happened. It put it on hold. And then you would get candidates like McCain that even had he been elected, wouldn't have stopped anything. He might have, again, maybe he would have pressed the pause button, maybe not. And the fact that he couldn't win against Obama, or which a lot of people have this romantic view of Obama's popularity, but what they don't remember necessarily is the fact that McCain wasn't exactly playing hardball, and neither was Romney. So you had these kind of wet noodles running up against this guy who should have been an easy defeat. There were so many weak spots in the armor, but they were so afraid of being called a racist or what have you that they didn't touch him. And especially, Romney totally had an opening and, folded like a wet paper bag. So here you had, after 8 years of Obama, after 8 years of, not just a left that was emboldened, but a left that was making, huge strides in their in what their agenda was. Obamacare obviously is a big one. But also, just, you know, immigration. You had the, you know, Obama, when he ran in 2008, couldn't say that he was pro-gay marriage, but by the time he left office, you know, we had trans kids and stuff like that. And that was just 8 years later. So like they were moving the Overton window on the left, huge amounts. And I think what happened was a lot of people, they began projecting a lot of their hopes onto Trump simply because he was the only candidate out of that, if you guys remember, that huge stage with so many different candidates that, you know, that resembled the Romneys and resembled the Bushes. In fact, one of them was a Bush. And they thought to themselves, well, this guy, when the media calls him a racist, it doesn't seem to faze him. He doesn't go into apology mode. And just because of that reason alone, because he wasn't apologetic, he wasn't groveling at the feet of the leftist media every time they slung some mud at him, he seemed like the alpha. He seemed, which is something that was sorely lacking on the right for many years. And excuse me, I got a little bit of a cough. So Trump became this larger than life figure that was just simply because of that. And I think a lot of people projected a lot of false narratives onto him, you know, even though in his, you know, while he was running in 2016, he said that he wanted a pathway to citizenship to, you know, for the Dreamers, the DACA people, whatever.
Yes, and he wanted a wall, but he wanted it to have a big door.
Right, you know, a big, beautiful wall with a big, beautiful door. And I mean, I did a montage. It's on my YouTube channel called The Art of the Schlemiel, where he was very duplicitous. Like he would say one day, "Oh, I'm a for gun control," and then I would, you know, juxtapose that with a clip of him saying that, you know, "I love guns," and this ranged on every subject from partial birth abortion. One day he's for it, and one day he's not. You know, to gun control, to, you know, immigration, to everything. Like he didn't seem to have an ideology. It was a personality. And that was the thing, it was the alpha male that was all that mattered. It was the fact that he was the guy that could, you know, get it done. And what the it was, no one really could determine, because he seemed to change his mind so much. And the other factor, of course, was Hillary was so awful. You know, in fact, when I first started getting politically involved during the campaign, my first project, I guess you could say, was called Evil Hillary. And I was just anti-Hillary more than I was pro-Trump. And I saw right away, after watching just one of his rallies, that he was going to win. I watched one of his rallies, and I had never seen, and I'd followed politics for many years, and I, you know, professionally was involved in politics for a while. And I had never in my life seen a politician on the right have like the star quality that Trump had. And I remember it was early 2016. I was still doing work with libertarians at the time. And I went to this think tank. I signed things. I can't specifically say all the details of this, but I went to like this think tank meeting, right? And they were just brainstorming stuff, libertarian stuff, but really it was also kind of, gathering people that had done work for them in the past, and I had done video work for them in the past, and they were looking for rising stars and that kind of thing, right? And it was an excuse to get a bunch of us in the room and evaluate us on merit, you know, like on ideology and that sort of thing. And the topic of the election, of course, came up, and they asked, like, well, who do you think is going to win? You know, it was kind of like that clip you've seen of Ann Coulter when she's on Bill Maher's show and she says, you know, Donald Trump, and the crowd just starts laughing. Same thing. I was like, no, it's going to be Donald Trump. And everyone's just like, yeah, okay. And I was the only one in the room that didn't come from like a very wealthy family, didn't have, you know, like the right pedigree, the right degrees and that sort of thing. And I realized, you know, wow, you guys don't see this coming at all. You know, like you do not see this, he's going to win. And, you know, sure enough, he did. But unfortunately, after the win, we didn't get any real successes. And part of that was, I suspect that there was the same amount, or not same amount, like the amplitude was different, but the frequency was the same of fraud involved in 2016, especially if these same machines were used, and in many cases they were. Broward County, I think specifically, there was probably some fraud. And I think they so underestimated Trump's appeal. You know, and if you read the emails that were released by WikiLeaks with Hillary Clinton's campaign talking about how they wanted to promote Trump. They wanted Trump to be the front runner because he would be the Pied Piper candidate, they called him. They would know, you know, if he cinched the nomination, that there's no way that he could win in the general. And so I think they vastly underestimated his appeal, and they vastly underestimated Hillary's the opposite of appeal. Whatever you'd call that.
Repellent.
Right. The repellent qualities of Hillary Clinton. And so I think that's why we saw like the delayed count in Broward County that on election night. If you guys remember that, when, you know, they took for, there was a lot of weird shenanigans and they finally came up with it. But I think it was just so overwhelmingly for Trump that they didn't have the ability to throw it. And, he won. And so for a long time, it was such a good feeling. Like all the people in the meme war, I mean, we'd spent so much time trying to meme Trump into office. You know, we were kind of surfing on a high from that, but also I don't know if you guys remember this the same way, but there was like a real nervousness, you know, because we all saw the way that the media and the deep state, if you will, were reacting to the election results already, like immediately. And, you know, we saw Antifa doing marches and burning cars and smashing windows and like law enforcement kind of just letting it happen. And
if I can just intervene, one of the first things that I remember about the immediate reaction to the election result in late 2016, I think it was in December 2016, the introduction of the term fake news.
Right.
And I'm convinced that Hillary did the Reno speech, I think, in August 2016. That was when she linked the alt-right to Trump, to Putin. And it was very straight. That was the start of the Russia narrative, but then which was just bizarre. But then in December 2016, the mainstream media as a totality, I think, were so troubled by the fact that Trump had won the election that they were struggling for an explanation. And so, how could this have happened? And how did the public defy us? The mainstream media. And so they came up with this theory of fake news. And it was kind of like a self-help therapy for the mainstream media. Why did they disobey us? Oh, it's fake news. It's this thing that's interfering, that's getting in the way of our message to the public and is misleading them. At least this is how it seemed to me. It was a sort of cope for the mainstream media journalists to believe that it's not because we are wrong or that we are hated, it's that the public are being misled by this system of lies that we're going to call fake news. And that seemed to emerge at some point in December 2016.
Well, and it is also an attempt to character assassinate people like us, because they realized that people were getting their news from alternative sources. So one of the reasons why they totally lost their grip on public opinion was a lot of people were tuning out of 24-hour cable news and tuning into YouTube or tuning into Twitter or what have you. And so they were like, oh, no, you have to, you can't look at those news sources. That's fake news. You know, that's, you have to look at the authoritative sources, you know, and that's why we had a lot of that, the tech companies who had meetings with, the Google meeting where like the people were crying in the meeting and, you know, we won't let this happen again. And
if I could just intervene one more time, sorry, because I want to draw a comparison between that and there was a Google thing, I think in 2012 or 13, where Sergey, the what's his name? One of the founders
Sergey
of Google.
Brin.
Him. I think it was him. And he said at this Google conference, we're reaching a point where censorship is going to be literally impossible on the internet. And he was saying that as if it was a good thing. He was celebrating that there was going to be complete freedom of speech. It was going to be literally impossible for the establishment to censor the internet. That was, I think, in 2012-13. And this illustrates the shock that they got in 2016, because what happened was that their side, you know, didn't win the battle of ideas. And I think they genuinely didn't see that coming. They genuinely thought that free speech on the internet will mean that we win every time.
Right, right. Well, that's the thing is the left believes in free speech as long as their message is the one that's winning. And look, you could say the same is true of any group that's in power. That free speech is really only applies to their sandbox of ideas. I mean, the right. The reason why the left were at least nominally, the champions of free speech in the 60s and 70s and so forth was because they were combating the censorship of the right. You know, the right had their blasphemy laws, and the left has their blasphemy laws. And but I remember when after the election specifically too. Everyone was so on ice or so on edge. I remember thinking, like, I don't know if this guy is going to even be sworn in. Like, he might get JFK'd, on the way to the inauguration or something like that. People were angrier at the result and more and irrationally so, as we can see now. I mean, what did Trump really do? I mean, he didn't throw. I mean, they were really thinking that he was going to put him in camps. And, Mike Pence was going to electrocute all the gays. And there was a real, it was like the existential threat got flipped. But because the right tends to be more rational in their thinking, the left, when faced with an existential threat, gets more hysterical in their reaction. And it wasn't just the groups that were fearing the rise of white supremacy and that sort of thing. But even institutionally, the media felt an existential threat. That's why they had to demonize the alternative outlets and try to shut them down, because they enjoyed a level of prestige and of power and influence, and they saw that slipping away. So, I think Once Trump was inaugurated, and actually even before Trump was inaugurated, and we find out later that Obama was spying on his campaign, the deep state, intelligence agencies were actively working to derail the Trump administration before it even started. They wanted to impeach him before. I mean, they were talking about impeachment before he was even sworn in, what happens, I think, because it was a cult of personality, because a lot of people were supporting Trump, not because of any kind of philosophy. What happened was people dug in, he's our guy and they're going after our guy. So they took it personally, like he was, it's like if you're at a bar and your friend gets in a fight, you're going to back him up, even if it's kind of his fault, because he's your boy. And that's kind of what was happening with Trump, is they saw him be under attack, and they saw him and it was mostly bullshit. Right. And so everyone rallied around him, and he had this momentum and this mandate. And it just, unfortunately, he squandered it for 4 years. And you could argue that, well, he was so tied up fighting, all these attacks from the media, and which even goes on today. Like, there was a press briefing, I want to say it might have been yesterday, where his hot little press lady, I forget her name, the blonde chick, she wrapped up after, giving the media shit for not reporting about Biden's son before the election. And then all of a sudden now they're reporting on it. And as she's walking out of the room, Jim Acosta from CNN yells, "Well, don't you think it's a little bad, weird to like say that we're passing out disinformation when you do it every day?" And it was the kind of shit that if someone had said that to me, like I'd fucking lay him out. And, and that's the kind of stuff that they would deal with every single press briefing. Every single press briefing was just like, It was like going into a den of vipers every single time. And the opposition was crazy like that. And I understand what Trump was up against, but a lot of this was of his own making. You know, if you're that worried about it, why even let Jim Acosta have press credentials? They control that. Oh, what are they going to do? Call you a dictator and a fascist? They already are. Who cares? And in terms of the investigations that went on, that was Jeff Sessions that let that happen. You know, Jeff Sessions let the Mueller investigation happen, and Jeff Sessions was picked by Trump, and he could have easily. And they're like, oh well, if we don't allow this investigation, there's going to be all this question about the Russian collusion stuff. He had to let it go. No, he didn't. Because look, did it help? Did it help that he let the Mueller investigation go to its conclusion? No, it wasted a bunch of time, and it wasted very very possibly didn't save him from not being or save him from a re-election disaster 4 years later. So all these problems were of Trump's making, or of Trump's inability to govern, really, because they had the Mueller thing was, like I said, it was totally up to him whether or not to do that. He chose not to go after Hillary. He chose not to go after Biden. I mean, the fact that there's all this corruption that we know that. I used to say this about Hillary, but the same thing's true of Biden. I used to say, a 12-year-old with internet access could indict Hillary Clinton. There's enough evidence in the public space that's publicly available, and let alone, like, who knows what the NSA has or the FBI has or whatever, all these spy agencies, they have got more than whatever the internet has. And, he chose not to go after Hillary. In fact, the day of the inauguration, he's told everyone to, everyone stand up and let's give Hillary and Bill a round of applause. She's a great person. And it was like, I knew then, I was like, oh fuck, you're not going to lock her.
Yeah. That was a bad sign immediately. Wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. And so that he just acts like, oh yeah, my hands are tired. He goes on Twitter and he complains about his own employees.
Well, this seems to be the big, big mistake that he made. The big error was that he surrounded himself with people who weren't interested in helping him with his project. He surrounded himself with Republican sort of identical people who didn't have the balls to do what he wanted to do. That's one interpretation.
Well, I suspect that. So here's something that I think that a lot of people that's going to be outside of a lot of people's narrative. Lynn Wood, one of the guys bringing one of the lawsuits with Sidney Powell right now, or I guess he's funding it, or his foundation is, or whatever. I watched one of his barnstorming, very, very theatrical rallies in Georgia. And while he was on stage, he was just, off the cuff. He didn't have any kind of anything prepared, as far as I could tell. And he let something slip, and I think he knew that he did it, because immediately after he said it, he looked, he looked a little uncomfortable and changed the subject very quickly. But he said, and I'm paraphrasing here, I'm not going to get this exactly right, but he said, I know Trump loves this country. I know he loves this country because I was talking to a close friend of the president's the other day. And he said, when Trump first decided to run, it was just to improve his brand. He wasn't even going to, he wasn't trying to be president. But then when he went around on the campaign, he saw that people actually really needed a president. And he decided, I'm going to give it all up and then come in and be the president. But the part that he let slip was, wait, hold on. So Trump's initial reason for getting into the presidential race was to improve his brand. It wasn't like some 40 chess. It wasn't some plan to save America. It was to improve his brand. And then once he saw the momentum behind him, he was just like, oh, holy shit, I can actually get elected. And I kind of think that that's sort of what happened. And so when you're like a guy like that in that position and you get elected, you have to rely on a lot of these people that have more experience than you, or you don't have to, but that's what he did, is he relied on Rance Priebus and all these other establishment Republicans. And that's who ended up being his cabinet. That's who ended up being, everyone that he nominated. And so that's, you can't drain the swamp by employing the swamp, which is precisely what he did. And then on top of that, he didn't purge anybody. He didn't purge these Obama holdovers. They keep saying this, like, oh, they're Obama holdovers. Like somehow they're like in their secret, you know, like somehow there's no way to know like who's the secret Obama holdover, like they're like terrorist cells or something like that. And it's like, no, you know who they are. You know who did the hiring? The guy. So right after the election, there was this big news, like when people were first starting to talk about the fraud, and the guy at DOJ who's in charge of voter fraud resigned in indignation, like, how, you know, I can't be told to investigate this fraud in this obviously free and fair election. And you take 5 seconds to dig into this guy's past. And he was put there by Eric Holder, you know, Obama's AG. And not only that, he was caught. If people remember this, when the IRS got in trouble for denying Tea Party groups and right-wing groups 501c3 status. And there are emails that are, again, these are public. This is, you don't have to work at the FBI to see these emails. There are emails between him and Lois Lerner, who was the head of the IRS at the time, where he's not just talking about let's deny them their 501c3 status. He's trying to think of ways to put them in jail. And so that guy was still there 4 years later. Four years of Trump, a guy who supposedly knew that voter fraud was on the horizon, right? Like he was talking about it in the debates that, oh, you know, we got to keep an eye on Pennsylvania. We know they're going to have a lot of fraud. He knew that was coming, and he had 4 years to get rid of the guy at DOJ in charge of voter fraud, and he left that guy in there. And it's that kind of thing, because that guy's just one guy out of many, many guys in the quote unquote deep state. And all these people saying like, oh, well, it's so hard to fire federal employees. Look, it is, but you can do it. You can do it. You just got to play fucking hardball. And that's just not something that he did. And I think that's that little microcosm is a perfect example of what went wrong with, and is still going wrong. I mean, fuck, Bill Barr was the replacement for Jeff Sessions. Okay, I'm going to get rid of Jeff Sessions, and then I'm going to hire a Bush senior's lawyer, the head of the CIA, you know, who's likely involved with JFK's assassination. I'm going to get that guy, who also worked for the CIA, by the way. Bill Barr's like first job was at the CIA. And you look at his history, like, of covering up scandals for these deep state Republicans in the 80s and 90s. I mean, this guy was a swamp creature if there ever was one. And so he's the guy that, and not even to mention Bill Barr's dad hired Epstein at one of his jobs. Like, I guarantee you that has CIA written on it somewhere, you know? And so there's a direct connection to Epstein. And that's not even the only connection to Epstein. Alexander Acosta, not Jim Acosta from CNN, Alexander Acosta was the guy, the prosecutor that gave Epstein the sweetheart deal in Florida back, back in the first time that Epstein got caught, and Trump nominated him to be the labor secretary. So it's just like, what are you doing? So either he has no fucking idea and he has no control and he's just this dumb boomer that's on cruise control, which is possible. I still haven't decided which way this goes, or he's totally in on it. You know, he's part of the swamp himself, and it's all just kind of theater. And it's a pressure valve situation. You know, he's there to make maybe soothe the anxiety that got him elected. You know, the existential threat anxiety. He was just put in there. Oh, look, okay, you guys, you got your guy. But I don't think that's the case, only because of the response that the deep state and the media had. I think.
Well, that's what I was going to go to. That, however incompetent he was, or however uncourageous he was, it does seem to me like they genuinely don't like him, and they genuinely feared him getting elected. They were genuinely shocked when he did get elected. They've genuinely hated him throughout, and they genuinely did everything they could to prevent him being reelected. But would you agree with that?
Yeah, right. No, exactly. And it was, to me, I really do think it's more of a just, you know, out of touch kind of a guy, especially when you hear the stories about the generals lying to him about troop numbers in Afghanistan. And again, this is literal treason that's going on. Like, there's so much treason, and no one's addressing it. Like, it seems like he has zero control over his own administration, zero control over his agencies. And then if you want to take it a step further, not that he should have control, but zero control over the types of Supreme Court justices he ends up getting. Like, the three Supreme Court justices that everyone was saying, like, oh, it was so important that, you know, at the very least, Trump was able to change the balance of the court. Well, was he? Because as we saw just the other day, when Texas brought that case before the Supreme Court, which absolutely was in their jurisdiction, which absolutely should have at least been heard, you know, it doesn't mean they have to rule in his favor, but to not even hear it is insane. And what, you know, none of those justices that he put in place backed him up on that issue. And so, and they didn't just punt, they punted in a very cowardly way, and which is totally unsurprising. That's usually what happens when right-wing issues reach the Supreme Court. So,
well, that brings us to the, oh, sorry, you keep going.
Oh, no, go ahead.
Well, I think that brings us to the issue of this election, the 2020 election. They seem to want to get rid of him and to prevent him from getting reelected. So what would you say happened here? How do you think this was done?
Well, there was absolutely fraud. Absolutely fraud. And I know there's a lot of people that don't want to admit that because they are so disappointed in Trump. They're so disappointed in the way that he treated the people that put him there, you know, and the way that he seemed to pander to all these groups that are kind of, I don't want to say our enemies, but, like, you know, in some ways. And it was very very convenient to say, oh, look, he lost the white vote, and that's why he lost. You know, like you see a lot of people saying that sort of thing. And look, there's maybe like a kernel of truth to that. But if you look at the evidence that's been presented, and I've watched all these hearings because I was kind of wondering, I was like, you know, is this just going to be a bunch of QAnon style, you know, people that just don't understand technology, right? Like, people that don't understand how the technology works or the process works. And because they're all QAnon sycophants, they think that there's no way Trump could have lost. But you listen to the evidence and there's clearly fraud, clear indications of not just a little bit of fraud, massive fraud in all of the states in question, and coordinated fraud in all the states in question. And in fact, if anything, a lot of these Republican state legislators are the ones that don't understand the technology, that don't seem to be able to wrap their head around that stuff.
Well, they don't seem to understand the technology in Silicon Valley, like the censorship. I remember one of these, is it Supreme Court hearings, the congressional hearings? I've forgotten what the term is. But they had, it was about a year ago now, and they had all these people, like, they were interrogating Zuckerberg, Jack Dorsey and stuff. And there were these old Republican guys there, these old, you know, guys of, and they were asking, so what are you, they, the ones who should be campaigning for more freedom of speech on these platforms, they were asking Zuckerberg and Dorsey, so what are you doing to combat hate speech on your platform?
Right. Yeah. I mean, how are you stopping fake news from spreading?
Precisely, that kind of thing. It was like they didn't know what they were there to do. So they were actually fighting for the opposition. It's just incredible.
Right. And you had a couple of those people like Ted Cruz that seemed to either he understood it or he had staffers that did that communicated it to him. And they would grandstand and they would say some of the good things that you'd want them to say. And people would clip out like those little portions of the hearing and, you know, spread all over Twitter and be like, yeah, you know, based Ted Cruz or whatever. But then nothing would fucking happen. And
indeed, and that's a thing in itself. Ted Cruz, and there was the other guy, Josh Hawley. I've forgotten his name now, but they would sometimes get some killer questions in there, but nothing happens. And you can tell from the body language and attitude of these people from these companies, not just the CEOs, but also their underlings. You can tell that they are not afraid. They're simply not afraid of the US government clamping down on them in any way. It's amazing, really. It's it's as if they know they're up against a completely impotent behemoth.
No, exactly. Would you be afraid? I mean, if you're sitting there, if you are conducting, I guess I would say, very sophisticated operations using technology that, I mean, it's almost like they're these boomers, these Republican boomers that we're talking about that were in those hearings that are supposed to be representing us. It's almost like you go back in time to the medieval times and have those kind of representatives trying to interrogate you about technology. And it's so easy to hide the truth from people who don't even understand what they're there to ask you questions about.
Yeah. And the other thing is that the technology is so complicated that it is like a black box. I mean, none of us know what is behind the curtain at Twitter, what actually goes on. How does that tweet relate to an algorithm? How does that algorithm relate to a database? How is that database compiled? Who are the people who compile the database? In which circumstances is that algorithm invoked? We cannot even guess. We cannot even imagine how complicated all of this is. And so, right. You'd have to undertake a very thorough investigation, and you'd have to understand the technologies involved, multiple technologies involved, in order to get to the bottom of this. Your only hope is that they will be honest about it and say, well, here's what we've done. Here's the very complex trick that we've pulled here. But of course, they're not going to.
Well, and that's another, you mentioned it would take a big investigation. Well, that's the other thing is, I remember in one of these hearings when they were talking to Mark Zuckerberg, and I forget which Republican this was, but he was asking questions and Mark Zuckerberg was being evasive. And he was like, well, we can always subpoena that. Well, then there's no follow-up. It's like, okay, if you do have subpoena power and you're not using it, and you should have been using it fucking 3 years ago at the very least. And you should have, every one of these senators that are on these committees should be qualified to be on these committees, or at least have staffers that are going to be able to communicate the complexity to them. They should have someone on staff that's not fucking 80 years old and, can't even operate their own phone. You know, you got to have people that not only understand the technology, but also understand constitutional issues and the crossover. Because if it seems like there's a lot of people that understand one or the other, you know, but they don't understand like the dangers. They don't understand the slippery slopes. It's like the second Silicon Valley decided to start deboosting or shadow banning people, where you're posting something and you think it went out no one else has really seen it. And you just think, well, no one's engaging in this because it just wasn't a very popular idea. As soon as that sort of a practice started happening, Congress should have gotten involved in one way or another, because that is 100% editorializing. And I don't know to what extent the Section 230 stuff is a solution to that, or, you know, Congress, as we've just, you know, since they're so incompetent, if they would just muck it up and make it worse somehow. I don't know what the solution is, but I'm telling you, neither does Congress. It's painfully obvious that no one in charge seems to have, you know, even the first idea, even what the problem is, let alone the solution.
Yeah, well, for sure. We got into this because we were talking about how they don't understand. They don't understand the voting machines, the technology there. And I said they also don't seem to understand the Silicon Valley stuff, the social media stuff either. So to return to the voting machines, the Dominion, I mean, again, it should be a very, very simple programming task to program a system that counts votes. I don't know how this is something that requires a lot of expertise, subroutines and everything, all the rest of it. But for some reason, it is. For some reason, it's a very complex thing. And of course, it means the introduction of, a curtain behind which you cannot see.
Well, right. And that was my first red flag. I had always known that these systems were insecure. But I always looked at it in terms of, they've got insecurities in their networking systems, or there's, you know, I always thought that like the system itself was probably, because it is so easy. It's just, you know, who did you vote for? I'm going to count that now. The end. That should be it. Like, that's a program I could have written when I was 11. You know, like, that doesn't take any kind of crazy, complicated knowledge. I mean, you're scanning something, you know, like a Scantron, like a multiple choice test, and you're just tabulating what you scanned. And it should be as simple as that. And maybe you have a problem with one of the scan things, and maybe it has to be adjudicated, like, you know, the process that we've seen. Okay, that makes a little bit of sense. But that should be it. Like, you don't need anything beyond that. And so when I saw that a lot of these issues, a lot of these exploits had nothing to do with someone having to hack in and change stuff, you know, like the fact that you could scan in all of these ballots and over and over again, for example, you could just get the same stack of ballots and just scan them over and over and over again. The fact that there's no real paper trail, the fact that you can there's no hard record to go through. So it's so easy that if you do the fraud, it's as simple as just, you know, shredding the ballots, or as simple as deleting a log file or something like that. The fact that there is some evidence that suggests that some of the tabulating takes place offsite, you know, whether it's overseas, you know, people have said, oh, there's like some server in Frankfurt or whatever, you know, whether that's true or not, it doesn't really matter. It should never be offsite. Or the fact that, that people are getting USB sticks and taking, oh, you get this USB stick and you take it out of this machine and then you put it in this machine and then it counts the votes on the USB stick. And it's like, it just sounds like the most convoluted, stupid system in history. And
it's like they've taken a simple task, a dazzlingly simple task,
right,
and have found ways to make it complicated so as to introduce vulnerabilities.
No, it seems intentional. It literally seems intentional. And these are things, by the way, these are all weaknesses that were identified by Democrats back in, I want to say, 2012. There was a CNN report back when Lou Dobbs was over at CNN where they had Democrat senators raising alarms over Dominion systems specifically. They said that, you know, this was a company that was bankrolled by Hugo Chavez. Like, all these same things that people are saying, oh, that's all crazy, tinfoil hat stuff. That was stuff that Democrats were saying back in 2012. And this is also
yes, and there's a thing from 2018, just 2 years ago. What's that awful English guy who's on? Is it Oliver? John Oliver?
Oh yeah,
he was apparently doing a thing 2 years ago about the Dominion voting machines and how corruptible they are.
Right, and Pocahontas, what's her name? Elizabeth Warren was raising some of these same questions. So these machines have been the target of ridicule and suspicion for a really long time. I mean, at the DEF CON conference, at the hacking conference they do every year out in Las Vegas, they had, you know, school children were hacking these machines. So the security aspect of these machines has always been, you know, out to lunch, and the complexity just creates all these other opportunities for problems. There is no secure encrypted log files that are ever kept. You know, the machine that they did, I think it was in Michigan, have access to do a forensic audit of. Mysteriously, the log file that it did have for 2020 was missing. It was just gone. But all the other years were still there from previous elections. But magically, the 2020, so someone was able to just go in there and delete a file, probably an unencrypted text file, you know, like the way that this stuff's programmed. And, you know, it's just, oh, I guess it's gone. We'll never know now. And because we shredded all these ballots here. And so that's the reason why Texas had standing in this case, and why the Supreme Court was just, they were cowardly. Like, the right is always, that's the problem that the people on the right are facing, is, and why they clung to Trump so much. Because it was like, I can't tell if you're cowardly or incompetent. It's hard or complicit. But either way, we're not getting what we want. And it's the same case with these Supreme Court justices, although I suspect it's cowardly and possibly compromised in their case.
Yes. Well, that would lead us back to Epstein and so on. But let's concentrate on the election, because, of course, the Dominion voting machines, that's just the sort of centerpiece of this. But there are other methods of fraud that seem to have gone on here as well. I remember during that night, I stayed up all night for the US election, and it was just nonstop. I mean, it was going on in real time. People were saying, what the what's going on here? What's this? What's this? There were, I mean, I can't remember now, but there was like 20 different things. I remember seeing a list of all the strange, suspicious stuff that was going on. And it was like 20 different things in that list. It was incredible. Unfortunately, I can't remember them now, and I don't have the list. But I remember there was a channel on Telegram called Metasite, which was listing them all. And then Mediatrix on Telegram as well was fantastic. These were my two sort of sources that night. And it was just, it was almost nonstop. The signs of corruption in real time were almost nonstop.
Oh, yeah. The videos being posted, you know, every couple of minutes there was a video being posted of an election. The people supposed to, they were supposed to babysit the counting. I'm blanking on the term, but the Republican representatives that are supposed to be overseeing the counting were being ejected while the Democrats were cheering, you know, and they were putting up cardboard over the windows. I mean, the stuff that at the very least, you know, when they talk about, when the DOJ talks about stuff that should be investigated, you know, even Comey was saying, well, you know, we need to investigate if there's even the appearance of fraud, you know, when they're talking about Trump. And this, I'm sorry, that's the appearance of fraud. Like, even if there's, even if everything ends, checks out in the end, that's something that the FBI, the same FBI that showed up to a NASCAR garage because some fucking idiot thought that like the pole for the garage door looked like too much like a noose. And, you know, because he's the black NASCAR driver, then clearly someone put a noose in that, like fucking 10 FBI agents show up to analyze this little piece of rope that turned out to just be the piece of rope that's been there forever, that you pull to close the door. That same FBI that thought it was very important that get investigated, the same FBI that investigated Jussie Smollett's ridiculous story about, you know, in the middle of a blizzard at 3 a.m., a bunch of hillbillies around, you know, came around the corner and threw a noose on him and said, it's MAGA country. That same FBI, that same DOJ, they see these videos that you and I are seeing of the cardboard being put up in windows, the election observers being ejected from polling stations, and the testimony from those, there were some election observers that were saying, no, I just literally just saw a truck pull up in the back here, and they're unloading all these fucking suitcases full of ballots and stuff. And look, some of this stuff might turn out that it's just bullshit, right? But this is stuff that nobody was investigating. And part of that was because Bill Barr. Part of that was because Christopher Wray, another nightmare appointee from Trump, someone who, by the way, one of the reasons why this Hunter Biden stuff's not getting investigated is because it turns out Christopher Wray and his wife benefited directly from some of these deals to the tunes of millions of dollars. So, I mean, he's literally put in place the people that are supposed to be keeping the deep state or whatever you want to call these people in check. He's nominating them to the fox is watching the hen house. And it's so frustrating to see even now with all the, now that the smoke has settled to some extent, the dust has cleared a little bit. And we've heard the testimony from all these election observers, election workers, the statistical evidence by itself. Look, I understand if people look at the statistical evidence and they dismiss it because they don't understand statistics, and it's hard to wrap your head around like how statistically anomalous something is when it's not something you study all the time. But when you couple that with also the eyewitness testimony, you couple that with the fact that the machine that they analyzed forensically was missing the logs should be an indication there was fraud. The fact that you had the local state governments extra legally conducting their elections, like that's the argument when it comes to a lot of these states where the state legislator sets out guidelines that are supposed to inform how the election is to be conducted, and then you have these judges making decrees from the bench outside of their authority, or governors making these decrees at the 11th hour before the election, using COVID as an excuse to have all these, not only that you have these nightmare machines with all these vulnerabilities, Then you have these, you know, the governors and these judges introducing even more nightmare scenarios in terms of how these elections are going to be conducted. All the mail-in ballots, which everyone has ever studied voter fraud has will tell you that's like the easiest thing. I mean, a child can tell you that that's super easy. That's way easier to conduct a fraudulent election if it's by mail than if it's by person. And again, then you had those the same, you know, as to that, you had the eyewitnesses, the contractors that worked for the Postal Service saying, yeah, I drove an entire trailer full of ballots across state lines. That's a felony. And nothing's happening, you know, like
and then there's the stuff about dead people voting, and then there's the stuff about ballots being destroyed, being burned,
even ballots Trump being found. Ballots. They're recovering ballots out of dumpsters, recovering ballots out of, you know, in fields, you know, people that were getting stacks of ballots delivered to a single address, you know, because if you look at the voter registration, you can look at, you know, well, how is it possible that 50 people live in this one, you know, location in a strip mall? It's not even a house. It's not even a residence. And so it's so easy to see that there was at least enough fraud to question the results, especially in some of these states where the result was rather close. And when the potential for fraud far exceeds the difference in votes between Biden and for Trump, you got a problem. And it's you know, we talked about why Trump got elected the first time. Why? Because the RNC has always been either cowardly or incompetent. Look at how the governors, the Republican governors in states like Georgia have responded to the fraud. They've punted the same way. They've in Arizona, there's a video of Doug Ducey, the governor of Arizona, who gets a phone call from Trump as he's certifying the state election results. And he looks at his phone and he shakes his head and puts the phone on the table. Like at that point, is it incompetence or is it complicity? And I think in Doug Ducey's case, it's probably complicit. But you have all these Republicans, quote unquote, in office at the state level that all they have to do is do their fucking job. Like they don't even have to do anything that's crazy. It's not like it's anarchy. You know, we're going against all precedent and all, you know, no, you just have to carry out your job the way it's described in the job description. And so all of these attempts to try to address this obvious fraud have failed one after another because the right has no representation. The right has no representation. They didn't, and honestly, they didn't even really have it in Trump, you know, and the reason I'm want the fraud to be addressed isn't because I think that really Trump's going to be, you know, this awesome president, you know, or maybe not even fundamentally different than a Biden presidency, to be honest, but because you can't let him get away with this. Because if you do, like, this is your last chance to stop them from getting away with this. You know, like if this kind of a fraud is allowed to happen, that's the way business is done now.
Yeah, in America, I mean, but also across, you know, the world, across the Western world, for sure. If this can be done with an election this prominent, then it can be done with any election. And go on.
Well, I just want to say, and I think that if you look back at how long they've been using these machines, I suspect that this exact kind of fraud has been going on probably maybe decades for all we know. And that's why it's just been, there's probably, who knows how many people are in office today that weren't really elected and may have been kept in office for decades that never won any of their elections. We don't know. There's no possible way to know.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I wonder in the 2024 election, if you're a right-wing American, you know, I can imagine a lot of people thinking, well, there's no point in me voting because it's rigged. And what would you say about that?
Well, there isn't a point in voting. And in fact, it's almost worse if you vote because your vote isn't a vote for your candidate. Your vote is a vote of confidence in the system. So it's worse if you vote.
Right.
I think that the ruling class would fear far more voter turnout being abysmal. Even if all their candidates they wanted won, if no one even bothered to show up, that's going to scare the shit out of them, because that says nobody believes the theater anymore. No one buys it anymore. And that's a dangerous situation for people who that's their moral authority, right? That's what gives them the authority to point guns at you and put you in prison and tax you, is the fact that, oh, we have this totally fair system that you have a say in. And if no one actually believes that anymore, that's a dangerous situation.
Indeed. And is the thing that gives them an appearance of legitimacy is that they were voted in. This is a key part of our democracy. that's the expression they always use in these identical news segments that you see being echoed around all the entire mainstream media. Our democracy. Well, you know, if the democracy is now a sham, then, yeah, as you say, if people realize that and wake up to that and react to it as if it's a sham, then that's going to be very scary. Do you want to say something about that?
Well, I was going to say, just particularly in the context of the American narrative, you know, whether how much of this is just mythos and how much of it is reality doesn't really matter. The average American, especially on the right, has this romantic view of the revolution, where we were fighting tyranny and, you know, we won against the unelected, you know, king, and we have self-governance now. And there's a lot of pride in that. And there's a lot of, that's a big part of the narrative in all of their minds. Again, regardless of the validity of it, that's what our own government has been telling us for over 200 years. And that's what government schools have been telling you, everyone, and your parents have been telling you. And so if that goes away, or that legitimacy goes away, and it starts to resemble what you were told your ancestors went and fought and killed and died for, what is that communicating to the public exactly? You know, so it's particularly dangerous in the context of, I think, Americans.
Yeah, well, that could be why perhaps, you know, the founding myth of America has been changed in recent years to it was a fight for equality.
Right, right. Now, and that's the thing too, is it's important to rewrite history, to update the narratives and update the mythos to control people, that's, you know, there was that movie about the moon landing recently where or was it the moon landing? I don't remember. I'll tell you what, I saw this movie recently called The 12 or something like that, but it was like some Go Die for Israel in the Desert movie, and about this special forces team that pulled off the impossible. They were like the first team released into Afghanistan. They did all this, you know, shit to go get the Taliban, and, you know, it's most of it's probably made up, but at the end of it, it says, you know, like, this was the team that pulled off this amazing feat, and it shows a picture of them. And now in the movie, this team was very multicultural. It was mostly white, but there was a black guy who played a prominent role. He was one of the main characters. One of the other main characters was a Mexican guy. And, there was two white guys, so like the main character, no one else, you know, were like, just they were just faceless people in the background. So it was like half not white in terms of the characters in the movie. You look at the photo, they're all white, you know. And so the reason they're doing that, and that sort of a rewriting of history, that revisionist history, is to the way I put it was, they're just training the your replacements to also want to die for Israel. And so it's the same kind of a thing that the left has been trying to deconstruct that narrative for, because exactly that. If your model involves a lot of tyranny, you can't have the population have this romantic view of overthrowing tyranny.
Exactly. And what you want them to be thinking about is equality, so that, well, then World War II, we fought the Nazis for the sake of equality. You know, that, which is not, that's not the case, but I know that there are young people now who are actually told that in school, on both sides of the Atlantic. And then of course that fits into what we're seeing now, which is that everyone is equally taken care of by the globalist state, by the Great Reset, and voting, well, we're all equally, well, our votes are always equal, and our silencing by the Dominion voting machines, it happens to us all equally as well.
Well, and the people who don't want to be insects in this insect colony, they're the ones that are the tyrants now. You know, it's no longer the people at the top that are the, you know, the people with real power that are the tyrants. Now it's the guy who makes $20,000 a year driving, you know, a pizza delivery, or like an Uber driver or something like that. Some guy that's the middle class white guy who doesn't want to be replaced in his homeland. You know, that's the tyrant now. You know, the tyrant isn't the billionaires that actually have, that are designing this insect colony for us all to live in. It's the guys who don't want to play ball.
Yes, indeed. That it kind of forces you into that position where you're saying, well, obviously, if this is what democracy is, then there is no democratic solution. I mean, there are some people who are now saying that. And that brings us actually to one of the questions that's come in. Is there a peaceful political solution to this kind of fraud? Can the US deal with it without a revolution or some gigantic game-changing event?
Yes. Well, yes and no. I mean, yes in the short term, no in the long term. It's just, I think we're in the middle of the start of an avalanche. And this is one of the larger boulders to get dislodged from its place. And so, because either way this goes, it's not going to be good, because, or in terms of like avoiding violence, because if, let's say, the Democrats get away with it and Biden's sworn in on the 20th, well, now, potentially, Trump tweeted out just the other day that 92% of Republicans believe that there was voter fraud. So now, potentially, half of the country believes, which I would say is more than the people who believed in the Russian collusion garbage, right? Half of the country is going to believe that the president is illegitimate in a way that has never maybe perhaps happened in American history. And so that's not going to go well. You know, that's not going to lead anywhere good. That's not when half of the population sees the government is illegitimate. And by the way, on top of that, you already know that the government's going to try to flex its muscles and do some authoritarian things that they don't like. And so that's going to escalate things. Or you could flip it around and say, okay, there's going to be some Hail Mary that takes place. And I don't 100% count this out. I still think it's possible. I think it's a long shot. But let's say somehow one of these legal cases does something, or, you know, these dueling electors that are going to be counted on the 6th with Mike Pence, and, you know, some crazy historical moment takes place where they count the votes for Trump. I mean, already for 4 years, the left has been hysterical over this illegitimate orange Hitler that's he's trying to be a dictator. And if you remember prior to the election, they were already memeing he's not going to leave. He's not going to leave. He's going to try to stay in office. And then it's going to be compounded by the fact that they had this release of thinking that Biden won, right? So oh, God, thank God we got rid of orange Hitler. And then if that gets snatched away from them right at the 11th hour, you think that they were losing their shit at the inauguration in 2020, screaming in the streets and burning cars and rioting. You haven't seen nothing. Like first of all, there won't be, if Trump, let's say Trump somehow pulls this off on the 6th, there's very likely would not be, I don't think, a public swearing in on the 20th. Because the risk would be just so astronomically high, not just to Trump himself, but any attendees. Like that would just be, it'd be insane to try to hold inaugurational ceremony at that point. So either way this goes, it's going to escalate the situation. And I don't think there's any way to avoid that. I mean, Texas, after their case was declined by the court, their official response, this is the official response, talked about secession. And people forget that Texas is the only state that I'm aware of, at least, that when they joined the union, that was written into the contract. They were the only ones that reserved the right to leave the union without any kind of repercussions. And if they just decided down the road that they didn't want to be part of the United States because Texas was big and they thought they could, you know, they didn't need us. And so we let them, you know, let them have that clause. And so this is the first time that I'm aware of that they are kind of hinting that they might want to take up that clause. And you have, it's not just Texas. You have other states that are kind of, you know, state legislators in Arizona, state legislators in other states that are kind of hinting around. They're not going as hard as that statement that came out of Texas, but that's unheard of. I've never seen anything like that in my lifetime, at least. And so we are kind of, I think, headed in that direction. Like I said, I think the avalanche is inevitable. I think we're going down a hill. And just it's just a matter of how rocky the road's going to be and how quickly the decline's going to be. But I think it's you know, you can't fight gravity. I think gravity is already doing its job, and it's just a matter of when and how much at this point.
Right. Here's it's not a question, it's a comment. I don't know what you'll think about this. Blatant fraud has been a part of national elections for generations. In this particular election, there is no reason to think it is more prominent. To think otherwise is naive, in my opinion. It's irrelevant. What would you say about that?
Well, I'm sure, you know, I don't know about blatant fraud, but yeah, fraud has probably been a feature of every election. I mean, even if you look at, there was that movie I did the review on of The Gangs of New York. And there's that scene where they want to they romanticize voter fraud, you know, where the Irish are double voting and they're voting at every precinct and they're, you know, padding the numbers and trying to that's the it was good. It was okay, though, because it was good voter fraud, you know, to get rid of the establishment. And so, yeah, it absolutely has been part of the American story. But
that's for the underdog, isn't it? That was Scorsese, who's not even right. Irish, you know. But it was the underdog. And I think one of the freakiest memes I saw coming out of this election was, you probably saw it yourself, it was about Star Wars. And let me think about this. So Trump getting elected was, oh no, right, okay. So Obama getting elected was A New Hope. And then Trump getting elected was The Empire Strikes Back. And then Biden getting elected was Return of the Jedi. And...
Kamala Harris kind of looks like an Ewok, so I guess that sort of works.
But it's an exact inversion of the truth. I mean, they think that Biden and the Democrats and the deep state and all that, that's the underdog. And yeah. Trump was the establishment. It's just astounding. I don't know how leftists can bring themselves to believe this.
Well, they're just not very sophisticated people. They're emotional thinkers, and they're just not sophisticated people. That's the beginning, the end of it, right there. In fact, I told my audience when I was doing a stream the other day, I was like, if you have leftists in your life, most of them, if you ask them, now obviously if they're like super politically involved, but like just the average person. In fact, this might even apply to the average person on the right, who the vice president is. You'd be surprised how many of them don't know. I mean, most people are so disengaged. Their political knowledge comes from late night talk show hosts, you know, or you know, like John Oliver and Stephen Colbert. You know, these people aren't doing research. These people haven't ever, poured through the WikiLeaks emails like I spent hours doing. These people don't even probably know who Epstein is, you know, that sort of a thing. So everything that their narrative is being crafted and delivered and then downloaded. And then they, you know, the NPC meme is real, you know, and it's on both sides, but it's on the left specifically. The NPCs, they download their firmware every so often, and it's written by people like John Oliver and Stephen Colbert whoever else is whispering in their ear, and it's delivered by Google, who is making sure they don't see any uncomfortable counter arguments, and Twitter, who also make sure that they never see any uncomfortable counter arguments. And, you know, a lot of these people, honestly, if they were given the time to see the counter arguments, might even be on our side, but they're just never even exposed to it because it's so easy to hide it from them unless they're searching for it.
Exactly. Okay, there's one question that's a super chat. So it's not relevant to the election, but I will ask it anyway because it's a super chat. Are you sympathetic to the increasing anti-capitalist third position sentiment among our ranks?
I'm sympathetic to it, absolutely. And I've said this in the past. I don't know what the solution is, and I don't know. I'll tell you one that I'm able to look at systems and point out where I would exploit it if I was trying to undermine that system. That's my gift, right? That's where my strength is. And when I see these more authoritarian solutions that have the probability of encroaching on my freedoms, I see that as a failure point. And because I do, look, my ancestors fought in the Revolutionary War. My ancestors have been here for hundreds of years. The American experiment, the Constitution, and all that stuff, that's a part of my heritage. And I do have an emotional connection to that. And look, I myself conduct my life that way, where I just want to be left alone, quite literally, you know, in the desert. And I don't want government having their – I feel like I'm – not everyone is – but I feel like I am smart enough and capable enough to be self-governing. And I think if the entire population still consisted of, you know, the founding stock, that would still largely be true. And I think that the reason why these more authoritarian solutions have an argument is that we have so destroyed our population's ability to self-govern through immigration of people who don't have a history of self-governance. But not only that, but just even some of the dysgenics that people like the Jolly Heretic has talked about that are a result of modern medicine, keeping people alive that nature would have put in the ground, you know, and that sort of a thing, where you have just kind of like a idiocracy kind of situation going on. And when the system gets so unruly and it gets so corrupt and the rot spreads to as many places as it has and it can't be easily eradicated, certainly in the short term, I think a solution is going to have to be authoritarian. You know, like, because you'll never be able to get a majority of the population, and this is specific to America, right? You'll never be able to get, you probably will never have a right-wing president ever again, just because of the demographics issues alone. So if you're going to try to solve demographics and you're relying on the demographics that you're trying to quote unquote solve to solve that problem, it's never going to happen. So any solution that's going to fix that is necessarily going to require some authoritarianism. And so I don't, but long-term, I don't know, because I just feel like any other system, it's going to have an expiration date. And how long is that? I don't know. Like, would it be good for a while and then slowly degrade, just like the experiment in America, you know, in 1776? Who knows how long that, you know, that'll go on for. But again, like, I'm not a solutions guy. I'm not the guy, like, when proprietarianism was being floated, for example, I was like, well, this is what's wrong with it. This is what's wrong with it. But I applaud you for coming up with this complicated, you know, plan that has a lot of problems. And so I'm the guy that'll point out the problems. I'm the guy that'll tell you how to knock down a building, but I'm not going to be able to design whatever replaces it.
That's a problem on the right, isn't it? So many of us are very good at analyzing problems and seeing the shortcomings of something, but we're not so good at coming up with solutions, I think, at least not yet.
Right. Well, and a lot of people will do that. There's that cliche, well, don't point out a problem unless you have a solution. It's like, well, this is a big conversation. These solutions aren't easy. I don't think there's going to be one like autistic guy in a basement that's going to craft the, you know, this is the solution. This is the thing that everyone's going to sign on. Because look, there is, people talk about like, the need for diversity. The right is incredibly diverse. You know, and to its dismay, there's a lot of diversity on the right, and it's going to take a lot of conversations, a lot of long conversations to get a lot and a lot of compromise here and there to get a solution that a lot of people are going to be willing to sign on to. But as Trump has proved, more than that, it's just going to require a charismatic leader. If Trump had wanted to install a fascist regime, honestly, I think he could have done it. Like, I think Trump could have already have undid the Constitution by now, because he had that kind of a following. You know, he had the people that are willing. And to this day, look, I'm one of them. If Trump were to tomorrow say, you know what, fuck it. This system is so broken that they're not solving this problem of fraud. And so I've decided that we're just going to go ham on these people, and we're just going to just start. I declare as president, I command you as president to go to your local legislators and perform citizens' arrests on these people, you know, and I give you authority to do this stuff. And, you know, you would have, people would do it. And I'd be there. I'd be there helping. I'd be in the back of the pickup truck with my my AR-15. And I'd be like, let's do this shit. And a lot of people would, like, all the Q-tards would be like loving that stuff. And look, I don't know where that would lead. Maybe it would be worse. I don't know. But that's more important, I think, honestly, in the short term than the ideology. It doesn't, because you could have, like, speaking of proprietarianism, as Kurt Doolittle proved very embarrassingly and publicly, that even if you have a reasonable solution, if you don't have a charismatic leader behind it, it's not going to get off the ground even. And so that's almost more important than having that solution is having that charismatic leader. And that's something that we lack too.
Yeah, I think Trump proved that in 2016 because he suddenly enlivened the right in a way that it hadn't been enlivened in my lifetime. You know, he seemed like he gave a sense of possibility and potential. And that was what was so intoxicating and exciting at the time. This idea that, well, we actually can strike back. We actually can combat the left because the left are shameless. The left are, they're so shameless. They're prepared to go for open fraud.
Right.
Yeah. They're shameless and they're galvanized and they're energetic and they're righteous. They're self-righteous. They believe in it at a moral level as well as a practical level. So I think what was so exciting about Trump was that he seemed to, well, he inspired a similar feeling on the right, but then deflated it through whatever, his own incompetence, his own lack of imagination, his own, or because he was afraid, or because he was complicit, which I think is the least likely of those. And then in the end, I think he was defeated by fraud, by electoral fraud in 2020. That's, and I don't know if that's the end of the matter, but I do think it's the latest chapter.
Right. Well, and all it would have taken for him to stay, like I said, this wouldn't even be an issue had Biden been investigated beforehand. And if because it takes a charismatic leader that not only has that ability to rally the troops, to get people together, but who also has the fortitude and the intellect to execute on that sort of thing. So the charismatic leader thing is half the solution. The other half is, you know, having like a plan, the same kind of a plan that the QAnon people think exists, that if it did, it would be fantastic. But that's the thing, is it's such a complex problem. There's not going to be one person that's going to, like I said, in a basement, that's going to come up with a end all be all solution. And even if they did, because people are imperfect and right now, not exactly high IQ by and large in America, you wouldn't be able to get everyone to sign on to it anyway. So I think people on the right know that, and that's why they're clinging to Trump and why they don't want to lose this position of power that they find themselves in, because they know that the second Trump goes away, it's going to just go back to where we were when Obama was president, where we have a bunch of these limp-wristed establishment cucks that just fold every time the left wants to accomplish something.
Yeah. Or worse, because of course it's going to be Joe Biden who, you know, there's that infamous clip of him saying that it's a good thing that America is going to be minority white.
Right.
And then you're going to get Kamala Harris. So it's going to be pretty ugly. And but I want to end on something of a positive note. It takes a charismatic leader, but it also takes someone who has a plan. But also the social intelligence, which I think, frankly, Trump lacked. If he is being defeated right now, which looks like he is to me, I think the number one reason was probably he didn't understand that this is not something you can do on your own. You can be the CEO of a corporation. You can't really be the CEO of the United States of America. You need to have other people around you who are backing you up and doing the things that who are fighting for you, not just following your orders. But obviously, I'm not an expert. And I'm not claiming to be. So, you know, that's just an improvised thing off the top of my head. All right. So let's leave it at that. There are some questions, but they're not related to the election. I want to keep this fairly concise and focused on the election. So we'll leave it at that. So, Devin, do you have any closing remarks about the election before we finish?
No, just like I said, like this, there is still a, you know, long shot chance Hail Mary that could take place. And if it happened, because it is, you know, we're living in strange times, I won't even be all that surprised if it does. In terms of how this is good for us, I've said this recently a few times that really it doesn't matter as much who wins at this point. How more so it matters how they win. So when this is all said and done and it's Biden and half of the country doesn't believe that he's a legitimate president, ultimately, if you're someone who, like as I do, who believes that we need to get in a situation where that's a mind space, where that's the way people are viewing the ruling class as illegitimate, that's ultimately that's good for us. And the flip side is, honestly, it's equally as good because you're going to have the other side of the country who's going to view the ruling class as illegitimate. It doesn't matter if it's your guy or not. But the faith in the system will have, I think, taken a mortal wound at that point. I don't think that the system survives this either way. And unless somehow, you know, Trump could still, which would be very un-Trump-like, could just bow out gracefully and make some kind of speech that smooths things over. I really hope he doesn't do something like that the last minute, like tries to calm everyone down. I hope he goes out defiant until the last moment. And that looks as though that's what he's going to do. And so either way, you know, don't let your heart be troubled, because either way, I feel like things are going in a direction that will ultimately, although it will be a rocky road, it'll be good for us.
All right. Excellent. Blackpilled, thank you for taking part in Millennial 2020. Everyone else, I'll be back tomorrow night. And the okay. So the first one is a surprise guest. It's a British guy. If you are in Britain, you'll want to watch that. It's at 8 p.m. on YouTube. And then, so that's, I can't reveal it in advance, but it's definitely, you'll want to be there. Then Monosity, then Eki Lux. Probably mispronouncing that, and then Philosophican. So that's tomorrow. In the meantime, I hope you've enjoyed this this night, the second night of Millennial 2020. Thanks again, Blackpilled, and I'll see you all tomorrow night.